Welcome, everyone, to episode 439 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we are finally getting to the Bye Felicias from the conference semifinals. So we will talk about what's next for the Denver Nuggets, the Utah Jazz, the Brooklyn Nets, and the Philadelphia 76ers. We will also check in on the conference finals, which may be on the verge of wrapping up. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is someone whom I'm assuming is still swept up in Euro soccer football craze, Martin Jensen. How's it going?
Only my own national team is going well. I don't think I have watched more than a couple minutes outside of my own country's games. So I'll be watching the next one. And it seems like England just won a big match. Which, yes. Okay, cool. That's nice. Denmark is coming for your asses. But you know what, Brian? To be honest with you, I'm doing okay. But I'm a little bit upset about something. So here's the thing. Brian Windhorst went on something called Shannon RJ on 105.3 The Fan. I don't know. That's in U.S. radio lingo, I suppose. Uh-huh. And he basically said, I don't know how many people are going to be excited to play with Luka. I think Luka is maybe a difficult person. He's a great player, but when you watch the Mavericks play, he's barking at the coach, he's barking at his teammates, he's barking at the officials, he's always barking about something. He can be really, he can really be an irritable guy.
Has Windhorst not been covering LeBron James for most of his career?
Thank you! I'm so glad you actually set that off your own accord, because that was going to be my point. Like, what are we doing right now? I wrote on Twitter when this came out, I was expecting this to rear its head, because it seems like every time a Euro raises his voice a little bit, it's like, oh, look, this is not something unique. I mean, Europeans are a little bit more brash. I mean, we all swear like sailors. You know me privately. I mean, I don't swear as much in the podcast, but you know how much I swear when we're off air. I have a more like brooding personality. I think that is very common for Euros to have that. This is a culture thing. Luka is 22 years old. He's been in the States for just 3 years. There's still this like acclimation period. It's not, you can't just say 3 years he should be like fully fleshed understanding of like how we function. Like, no, he's a young guy still trying to learn more about himself, about the States, also trying to figure out like that tough balancing act of what to say to the media, how to communicate with teammates. I think this is such a headline grabber in a bad way, like I'm trying to make something big out of absolutely nothing.
I'm very glad that I no longer have the time to listen to all of those other podcasts, because good Lord, sounds like I've missed some truly terrible hot takes.
Yeah. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. I don't think Luka is going to be a problem. I would still trade for him, I should say, if I had the opportunity, whatever team I was supporting, I would pay everything to get Luka on my team, and I wouldn't have any issues with his irritable personality or whatever the hell Windhorst apparently called it.
You know what is going to be a problem, Mort? Is Trae Young's foot. Because he suffered a bone bruise in his foot. He stepped on like a referee toward the end of the third quarter, game 3. Did come back to play in the fourth quarter, but got buried under a salvo by Chris Middleton. Chris Middleton, I believe, outscored the Hawks in the fourth quarter, which is just phenomenal. All of our caping for Chris Middleton over the years finally paid off. So yeah. The Bucks are now up 2-1, stole home court advantage back. They are currently a minus 1,500 favorite to win this series, minus 6.5 going into game 4 tonight. Mort, is this series over if Trae Young is in any way hampered by that foot injury?
I think it is, but before I paint the Hawks in this doom and gloom thing, I want to point out they were right there.
I mean, this was not one of those games that came easy to Milwaukee. I mean, the Hawks were constantly there. They're not going away. They are very similar to the Los Angeles Clippers, who we'll talk about as well, as just one of those teams that doesn't go away. I think their moxie, their aggressiveness, the fact that they're playing with house money and just it, like going all out, all confidence, is fantastic. And I honestly, I think if that hadn't happened with Trey, they probably would have won that game. Honestly, they might well could have. So, yeah, no Trey, that's an issue, because who do they have in terms of shot creation at that level? They just don't. I mean, Chris Dunn? No, it's not going to happen. And you can't ask Lou Williams to take over, like, playmaking role. You just can't. Like, and while Bogdan Bogdanovic is a fine playmaker, he's not of that ilk whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like, they just... they wouldn't have that passing component. It would be a whole bunch of very, very talented players who would be looking for their guards to, hey, help me create a shot, and that help won't be there. So I think if he's out, if he's limited in any way, unfortunately, like that's that. And when I say fortunately, unfortunately, because I don't want any team to go out this way. I think that's the unfortunate part. But then Milwaukee's in the driving seat, absolutely. And if somehow they should lose a game to a non-Trae Young team. And, like, we're laughing, but, I mean, that could happen.
Oh, like, for sure.
Rolling it out.
Yeah, never doubt then, Mike Budenholzer's ability to screw things
up. Right. Then I would be seriously concerned about the well-being of the Milwaukee Bucks.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, I think Trae Young, I think he's listed as questionable. I have every expectation that he's going to play in this game and moving forward. Yeah. I just don't think he's going to be 100% Trae Young, unfortunately. Yeah. And I think the Bucks have done a really good job. I mean, game three, he had 35 points. We had a really nice bounce back from that awful game two.
Yeah, he did.
But they've been limiting his impact. You know, game one, we said that this was their strategy. They were going to let him go for 40, but they were going to limit his impact as a playmaker. They didn't do either. So that was a faulty strategy. Games two and three, they've done much better in terms of, I mean, A, just playing better defense on him in game two. But then game three, I mean, he only had 4 assists, 4 turnovers. So they really have cut off a lot of his passing lanes. You know, Bogdan Bogdanovic is just, he's looking a little better. But those first couple games, you know, the knee seems to be bothering him a lot. I can't imagine playing every other day at this point. He's going to get substantially better. So it does just feel like this Hawks team is probably running out of steam a little bit. That said, I think you're totally right. It sucks to see them go out this way if this is what happens here. Because, you know, you're totally right. If Trey doesn't get hurt, they very easily could be up 2-1 in this series right now. And we could be looking at this game, you know, going into tonight as, like, this is the Milwaukee Bucks season right here.
Right. Yeah, that it's crazy what, like, a smaller injury can do. Really? Yeah. I mean, I always go back to this because I think it's interesting how, like, a single injury, like, for example, Derrick Rose's ACL back in 2012, of course. I mean, how that could just, that changes like the next 5 years of a franchise, right? It rides so much. Like if Zion Williamson, I'm knocking on wood here that it doesn't happen, God. But like if he like tears his Achilles or something like that, right? I mean, it completely changes the entire future of the New Orleans Pelicans. So injuries suck, especially when it's so late in the playoffs and things are actually going well. You've built all of this fanhood and like movement and progression, and then you're so far into it and it goes wrong. It I think he's gonna play. I hope he's gonna be effective, but if he's not, that is just going out on a whimper, and they don't deserve that. The Hawks, their fan base, they deserve so much better. What a season they've had, and hell, maybe what a hell of a season they keep on having, because we don't know. Everything is still possible, but if they go out this way, I will be very, very sad on everyone's behalf.
Yeah. I will say this. Next season, they're going to be even better. So that is one silver lining for the Hawks fans to look forward to, even if they do go out like this. And Trey's injury is the reason why. Like, they have most of their key contributors under contract. They, you know, look ahead a couple of years, and it gets very dicey quickly. But next season in particular, y'all are going to be fine. Just enjoy this while it lasts.
Well, one question about that, actually, because I want to ask you very quickly just about the Hawks' future, because you know how there are all these ratings nerds who are basically saying, oh, you know, it has to be the Lakers, it has to be the Knicks, it has to be the Nets, it has to be the big markets, that's the most fun, yada, yada, yada. Like, in terms of pure entertainment, you would want the Hawks to go as far as they can. They're fun. They're extremely fun to watch. Like, one thing is that they're so good, but, like, they're extremely entertaining. When you watch their games, you are entertained for the vast majority of the entire game. And yeah, Trey has some antics here and there, I get it, but like, they're so crisp. The offense is flowing when they're hitting their strides, and even when they're hitting their strides defensively, they can be fun as well. I mean, as the NBA looks at that team moving forward, you would almost hope to get them further into the playoffs, because they should be an attention grabber. They're so much fun to watch.
Yeah. And I honestly feel the same way about the Phoenix Suns and the Clippers as well. Yeah. This version of the Clippers, like I tweeted this last night, because, you know, as Reggie Jackson was once again going off for a fantastic performance, and Ramona Shelburne of ESPN wrote a great piece about him. And, you know, like, for all of the focus about, oh, we don't have LeBron, we don't have the Warriors, like, we don't get Trae Young's emergence as this, like, new trash-talking villain. We don't get Reggie Jackson's redemption after, like, you know, Ramona's story says he like thought about retiring after that Detroit stint, where he was just, you know, injury hampered and not his usual self. Campaign, who was out of the league 2 years ago, like, we're getting so many great news stories, and this is the way to grow the league, is by involving more teams and more new stars. Like, the, you know, if we have LeBron James is an all-time great, I'm never going to dispute that. But
agreed.
If it's LeBron James's 11th finals, I could see why a casual fan isn't that entertained. It's like, okay, it's the same crap every year. But now, you know, like, oh, wow, Paul George is, you know, keeping this Clippers team alive despite not having Kawhi for this entire series. Like, he's quashing the pandemic P nickname one game at a time.
Yeah.
Like, Paul George last night... Paul George, who caught nothing but crap for an entire offseason about how he played in the playoffs last year, without Kawhi Leonard, down 3-1 in an elimination game, has 41 points on 15 of 20 shooting, 13 rebounds, 6 assists, 3 steals, 3 threes in almost 41 minutes.
It's amazing.
I mean, it's like, these playoffs have been fantastic, even if they haven't had, you know, the typical, like, superstar LeBron, Steph Curry, whatever. It's like, even still, we're most likely heading for a Suns-Bucks finals. Like, I, you know, someone replied to that tweet last night. I was like, sorry, but I just like watching the best players. It's like, you're going to have a finals with Giannis, Devin Booker, Chris Paul, Chris Middleton, Drew Holiday, DeAndre Ayton. Like, there's plenty of star power in there. Just because it's not the one that the league has been hyping up for the last few years doesn't mean those guys aren't phenomenal basketball. Like, Giannis is the two-time MVP, for God's sake.
Right. Yeah, and honestly, I mean, you know, we're seeing ratings records set right now. And I think partially that's also because you're finally seeing, you know, lesser teams, lesser market teams make it. People are like, what is this all about? And then you have the support of course, local fans who tune in, like going, finally, my team is like getting some attention. And this is only good for the league. Having the same teams being rehashed all over again. I think it was David Stern years ago who said that their dream NBA Finals matchups would be the Lakers versus the Lakers. I mean, sure, but you would tire folks out with that, like, kind of logic. You need years like these. You need to have some turnover. I think this has been great for the league, not just in terms of entertainment value, but also just kind of laying the seeds for the future, because Trae Young, he's still going to be great moving forward. Devin Booker is also super young, as is DeAndre Ayton. I mean, these teams are going to stick around, presumably, and then there are going to be more teams coming into that hunt. I actually wrote about that for Forbes as well. I have two articles up recently basically detailing that the league's future is very, very bright. In a couple of years, we could see Detroit back in play with Cade Cunningham. I mean, the league is so wide open, and that's fun. That is objectively fun.
Yeah, completely agree. So let's briefly touch on the Clippers as well, Mort. As I mentioned, they have staved off elimination. They're on their, if they have nine lives, they've got to be on their eighth by now at least, right? Like
pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, down going into this game, also down Zubac. We wrote them off after game four when Kawhi went down. Game four of the Jazz series when Kawhi went down. When Zubac was ruled out ahead of game five, it was just like a collective. There's no way. This team is just done. It's over. Good night. And Marcus Morris comes out on fire in the first quarter. DeMarcus Cousins out of nowhere, 15 points in 11 minutes. And then Paul George, Reggie Jackson. Just, I cannot say enough about this Clippers team. And the Vegas, all of a sudden, I mean, the Suns are still up 3-2 in this series. But they are now only a minus 550 favorite to win the series. The Clippers are a plus 410. So this is from FanDuel Sportsbook. So odds makers are now scared that, like, this Clippers team just will not die.
Right. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. This is the thing with Bookie as well, right? I mean, 11 minutes, 15 points. He just came in and he jacked up shots. 12 shot attempts in 11 minutes, by the way. But the skill level is so incredibly high. And we have this tendency as NBA fans to always talk about, like, oh, defensive matchups, defense. I know that I've been harboring us on this point a lot over the past month or so. But, like, look at the benefits of also having someone who can just put the ball in the basket. Like, without him, do they come out of this game? I don't know.
Yeah. I like, analysis is out the window at this point. Because, like,
right?
It's the Suns, by every objective measure, should be in the finals already.
Yep.
But, this Clippers team just refuses to quit. And it's, like, I'll say it every episode until they're eliminated. And then even afterward, I am so impressed by the resilience of this team, especially coming off of the collapse last year. And I don't know if that is what changed them, if, you know, Ty Lue is, how much credit he deserves for this. I think a lot of members of Sixers Twitter in particular are pretty sad that, you know, the Clippers switch from Doc to Ty, because Ty was either running for that Sixers job, and it would be certainly interesting to think about how the playoffs would have gone had Doc stayed with LA and Ty been in Philly.
And Philly fans should also be a little bit weirded out by the fact that Reggie Jackson has been so much better in the playoffs this year than Ben Simmons.
Yeah. Also not great. We'll get to that a little later. Mm-hmm.
But, like, Reggie Jackson, sorry, but I have to read you his numbers for the playoffs. I really
please,
do. Sorry.
Please do.
He's played 18 games in the playoffs this year. 18 points, 3 rebounds, 3 assists, which is fine. Like, he's not a high-volume playmaker. He's not a high-volume rebounder. Like, he's a scoring point guard. But the percentages, Brian. 49% shooting overall, 41.5% from downtown, and almost 87% from the free throw line. I mean, he has been outstanding. And you know what? I kind of realized what he's been. He's been Derek Fisher on steroids.
Mm.
Because remember back in the day when he played off of Kobe and Shaq, he was not a traditional point guard. He wasn't a table setter. He was a guy who was brought in to feed off of the attention of Shaq and Kobe. So he would take, you know, spot up 3-point shots and the like. That's Reggie Jackson's task right now, is basically, okay, I'm going to walk into open 3-point shots. I'm going to walk into open layups. I'm going to walk into just open shots, generally speaking. And he's doing that, and he is becoming one of the most dangerous scorers in the playoffs this year. I love it. I love this evolution from him. He's just completely went in on the whole, I need to be able to shoot from downtown, and I need to do so reliably. And by looking at the numbers, he might have turned a corner and become one of the most efficient long-range shooters in the NBA.
Yeah. I mean, certainly good timing from his perspective, because he's going into free agency, and he's about to get himself a bag after this playoff
performance. Yeah, what kind of bag do you think he's going to get?
Oh, man. I believe I have to double check this because I haven't been paying a ton of attention to the Clippers salary sheet. I think they are limited. I think they only have his early bird rights, don't they? They must.
He played. Yeah, I think so. He played last year as well. So yeah. It's 2 years. Yeah, so it's 175% of the cap, right?
Or his former cap hold. Or above the average salary, like slightly above the average salary. So I think the number that I saw floated somewhere, and I don't remember where, apologize to whoever tweeted this out, but I think he can get up to $10.1 million from the Clippers. I don't know, like, in terms of, I think there are going to be other teams that offer him more money than that.
Yeah.
But Ramona's story makes me think he's going to stay with the Clippers for that amount of money.
Yeah.
Because it just, I didn't realize, like, he and Paul George are super close. And, you know, I think her story was called, like, Reggie Jackson feels like he found a home with the Clippers.
Yeah.
You know, this.
Yeah, look, if you're getting paid $10 million to stick around a team that's winning and your best buddy's on there, I mean.
Yeah, right? And, like, you know, he got his big contract already. So it's not like this is a guy coming off of, you know, like a Shake Milton looking to cash in for his first big contract. Like, you get an $80 million contract. And $10 million is still nothing to sneeze at here. But yeah, I'm sure, you know, would the Knicks not offer 2 years, $30 million, something like that?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that in a derogatory way to the Knicks. I think it would be a good offer.
Oh, yeah, and he would be a good upgrade, but that's when the personality things come in. Like, you have a buddy, you have a system, you know that this franchise gave you new NBA life. I mean, that matters. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Yeah. So, what's your read on this series moving forward? Like, we still don't know what's up with Kawhi, which I'm assuming odds makers are also factoring in here. Like, if Kawhi makes a surprise return in Game 6, all of a sudden those Suns' futures are not looking so great. But I still assume he's out for the rest of the series.
Yeah, I would assume so as well. I hate when you ask me this, and I know you told me I'm going to ask you every single episode.
Every episode.
And it's because it's so up in the air. I have no clue. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I have the inside scoop. I don't know. It feels like it would be Phoenix's game, like, next time around, but I don't know. Paul George could decide, you know, 41 wasn't enough. Let me go for 50. I don't know. Jay Crowder could be 0-for-9 from 3. Yeah. There's so many variables here.
What do you make of the Suns? Like, as much as we are praising the Clippers here, what do you make of the Suns' inability to close them out?
I mean, I think it is difficult to score against length and switchability, which the Clippers do have. I mean, think of Marcus Morris, what you will, and I certainly think he's a dirty player, but he's also long. Like, he's able to move his feet. Paul George as well offers a lot of length. Pat Bev is just a bulldog. Terrence Mann is feisty. Nick Batum, like, despite being 170 years old, can still defend, is still long. You have some flexibility there, and I think maybe that is something that could be bothering the Suns when they're trying to go for jump shots, when they're trying to do something. And I wouldn't even be shocked if they actually try in Game 6 to establish Ayton a little bit more. I'm hoping that they do, because he played, give me a second, 37 minutes, and he took 9 shots.
Yeah, that was his first real off game pretty much of the entire playoffs.
Right. So, and by the way, just, I'm not putting that on him. I think this is where the Suns need to acknowledge sometimes, hey, we have an option here that we can go to. Like, sure, we can't force feed him like he's Hakeem Olajuwon, but we can go to him on certain matchups. There are certain times where we actually have to get just some offense squeezed out, get it into the big fella. He's shooting over 70% from the field in the playoffs. Odds are he'll make something happen in one way or the other. And I'm not saying you should, like, give him 25 shots, but if you finish a game where he plays almost 40 minutes and he doesn't even take double-digit shots, I think your game plan needs to adjust.
Yeah. And especially, you know, going against a Clippers team that was without its starting center presents some challenges. Right. You're downsizing, and it's going to be a challenge defensively.
Who was the tallest player outside of Cousins, who played 11 minutes? Who was the tallest player to play, like, proper minutes? I know Toro played, but, like,
probably Marcus Morris or Paul George, right?
Yeah, right. Like, Paul George at 6'8", 6'9".
And Marcus Morris did a very good job standing his ground against Ayton.
Yeah.
I think he deserves some real credit for that. There was a play early in the game, I think it was early in the game, where, you know, Ayton was he tried to establish position in the post and just like bowled over Marcus Morris, but they called it an offensive foul. And I wonder if that set a tone for Ayton, like how they were officiating him against a smaller player. Yeah. And maybe he was like a little nervous to, you know, it's different if he's going against a Jokic or an Embiid, because it's two bigs battling. They're not going to call as much incidental contact. And like, you know, Marcus Morris flew 5 feet back when Ayton did that. So it was hard to ignore that. I think it's a clear counter in game six for sure.
Yeah. Like if he just sets up shop on the low block and you pass it to him on an entry pass and he almost goes straight up with a right hand hook shot or something along those lines, like I'll take that. Mm-hmm. If I'm the Suns, I'll try that out. And if that doesn't work for a couple of times, then I'll pivot into something else. But I would try it. You're right. I mean, maybe he got into his head about that call. That's just us speculating, of course. But you're right. Sometimes the whistle can change your level of aggression. Absolutely.
Yeah. I also think we are long overdue for just a Mikal Bridges game.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we haven't had like a big, his highest scoring, he had 23 points in game one against Denver. Other than that, 16 was his highest scoring game of the playoffs. Like, we're definitely, yeah. You know, there's some game where Mikal Bridges hits like four or five threes and that swings it. It just hasn't happened yet, but Phoenix can only hope it happens soon.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, right? Because it seemed like in the regular season he was really coming along. He was extremely efficient. I think, was it something along the lines of 52% from the field overall, or more even? And then like 40%+ from downtown. Like he was really hitting almost everything for a wing guy. And then you kind of came into the playoffs with the expectation that he would mimic that, and he just didn't. He kind of reverted back to missing a lot of shots that he wouldn't have in the mm-hmm. regular season. And then you're looking around going, okay, Mikal is not producing to the level that we're used to, so we need to find that elsewhere. And maybe sometimes that means going to Devin Booker a little bit more. Maybe it means to go to Chris Paul a little bit more. But I agree with you. It would be nice if Bridges just came in the first quarter of a game and had like 12 points and just got his confidence level back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they have found more offense through Ayton, to his credit. But yeah, I think a Mikal game would help shut the door for sure.
Right, right. Exactly. Like if he came in and had a 25-pointer, that would definitely change.
Yeah, that'll do it. So, of the series. If you had to pick today, who's your champion? Oh. I changed my mind already.
I'm going to change it again, probably. I'm still going to say Bucks just because I don't. Look, I could go the movie 21 route. I don't know if you've seen that mm-hmm. with Kevin Spacey and all those guys. Like the whole variable change thing. I just go, I can change my pick and then I'll have another 33% chance to get it right or whatever. Like if you have three doors, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stick with my emotional pick for the first time around with the Bucks, and I'm probably going to be wrong.
I actually would switch from the Suns to the Bucks right now. I think if the Bucks don't win the title, something went horribly wrong. That something was probably Mike Budenholzer.
Yeah, but is that logic you can apply to them actually winning? Like, if you're saying, oh, we can't lose that, okay. Like, I'm sure 30 teams in the NBA at the start of training camp every single year says, we can't lose this year.
Yeah, but, the Suns not being able to close out the Clippers in this state, yeah. And then, like, that rock-throwing fest in Game 4, they just haven't played super well in this series. And that makes me nervous because I still don't know what their answer is against Giannis in a potential final series either.
I'm also feeling like we could see a Devin Booker just like one of those flaming scorch earth games.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go into Bye Felicias because we're soon going to have to do two more. So we had to squeeze them in today. Let's start in the West, Mort. We have the Denver Nuggets, you know, we said it time and again, without Jamal Murray, they were drawing dead in this series. You know, it's, you don't want to take away too much from that I don't want to overreact, but they do have some big decisions that they have to make this summer. The first of which, Will Barton has a $14.7 million player option, which I would assume that he's going to decline. Would you want to bring him back if you're Denver? And if so, how much would you spend on him?
It's a good question. I would want to bring him back because I think he's one of those guys who's a bit of a glue guy. Like, he can do a little bit of everything. Not that he's like a premier ball handler or a premier facilitator, but if you ask him a couple games out of the season to say, you know what, maybe Jokic doesn't have it, maybe Jamal Murray doesn't have it, like, go be our main ball handler, go get us like 8 assists and go get us 20 points, I think he has the capability of going to do that. But it's the question of what does he give you in the playoffs. I think he only played 3 games this year, so that's such a small sample size, but he delivered. Like, he is a player who can come in and spread out the offense. He can rebound. He can defend. There's a lot to like there. I don't know what the cost should be, though. I mean, if you're all in, like Denver seems to be right now, maybe you don't care about price tag and you just kind of keep him around for whatever he and his agent wants or something mm-hmm. that's reasonable at the very least, and you just go, you know what, we'll figure it out later. So if there's a trade that suddenly pops up, then you can work it from there. But you just need to basically retain the level of talent that he has and then figure something out later, because it's not like they're going to be flush with cash moving forward.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, if Mike Malone had his way, I think he would certainly want Will Barton to return. Mm-hmm. And part of it, too, is what's your plan B? You know, we assume once Jamal Murray is healthy, he's the starting point guard. You're going to have MPJ and Gordon as your starting forwards. Jokic is the starting center. So Barton should slot in as the starting two guard or whatever you want to call it. What's the plan B if you don't bring back Barton? Because as you said, they're not going to have a ton of cap room, even if, right. you know, everything, like all of their non-guaranteed contracts, like Jamichael Green doesn't pick up his player option either. You'll have maybe a couple million at most. And it's like, you're going to have to probably decide between PJ Dozier, I guess, gets the first shot, and then your boy Marcus Howard. But like, are those yeah. guys the starting twos on a title contender?
So I'm actually pretty optimistic about PJ Dozier of all, not to the point where I'm thinking that he should be some full-time starter right off the bat. That would be just too optimistic. But I do think that he would come in and definitely take some of that responsibility away from Will Barton. If they lose him, then he could kind of usurp that. But no, you're right. You want to be as fully loaded as possible, given the championship aspirations that you do have. So it's no. To answer your question, no. PJ Dozier and like let's look over the roster actually. Facundo Campazzo, Monte Morris. Like, those guys just wouldn't be enough. You brought up Marcus Howard as well. No, I think you need Barton. There isn't someone on that roster that really come in and do what he does. And I also don't think that option is going to be available for a normal price tag in free agency. So, no, you're. Mm-hmm. I think you're probably handcuffed in getting him back.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you're worried about, is Will Barton the long-term fit, he doesn't have to be. You can re-sign him with the full intention of trading him later. Because right now,
the Nuggets have done it before with the Nene.
Right, and they don't have a ton of trade. Like, you're not trading Jokic or Murray in theory. Gordon is heading into the last year of his deal. Like, you don't have a ton of those mid-range tradable salaries. So if they aren't convinced that this current core is right, they don't have a ton of options to upgrade at this point. So I think re-signing Barton, you know, don't, like, if he wants a max, don't do that. But I don't think he'll get any.
Oh, no, no.
I don't think he's getting a max contract. So, you know, it might behoove them, honestly, for him to just pick up the player option and they can punt on that decision. But if not, you know, I would bring him back, hopefully right around that same price, around, you know, $15 million a year.
You brought up a good word there, punt. Because I have to ask you, not to say they should punt on next year, but we know. No. But like, we don't know if Jamal Murray is going to be Jamal Murray of this year. Hopefully he will be. But mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it takes guys a year to come back from that and really get like that full trust back in their knees. And I mean, maybe Murray is wired differently and he just goes, you know what? I'm fine. Let's play. And in which case, that would be great. But you don't know. So I wonder, like, if they come out sluggish, if Murray is clearly, like, working his way back, what should their, like, should they course correct? What should they do? Should they instead get rid of bloated contracts and try to retool for 2022?
Yeah, I mean, our mutual friend TJ McBride has been harping on this point about the timing of Murray's injury being so devastating for Denver because, you know, we can get into the other big storyline for them this offseason is that Michael Porter Jr. is heading into the final year of his rookie deal, which means he's up for a contract extension. You know, Gordon is now heading into the final year of his contract as well. So ideally, you would have had, you know, after the trade deadline, 2 months of the regular season, a full playoff run, and then you can use that to evaluate how much do we give MPJ, and then you have another full season before you have to make a decision on Gordon. Now the Nuggets aren't going to have the luxury of that. They had barely any time with the four guys healthy and together. So first with MPJ, I'm assuming his agents are going to say max or nothing. Would you be willing to give him the max?
Oh, yeah. See, I knew that when we were going to be doing this by Felicia that you were going to be asking me this. By the way, Michael Porter Jr. 23 today, so that means he's just so super young. I mean, the upside speaks for itself, right? 19 points, 7 rebounds. And like at that age, and his shooting has been outstanding. I mean, he made almost 3 triples per game this year at 44.5%. Like, he is legitimately one of the best 3-point shooters in the entire league. And something that also, like, I think it's fair to address this. It sounds like from some people we know that he's also matured a lot. Like, there were issues initially with some of his teammates not exactly being all that friendly with him because of certain things, but it seems like he's actually taken that to heart and grown and matured and realized, oh, you know what? That tiny bubble I lived in when I grew up, that is expanding now. And if that is something that is true, which I want to believe in, then absolutely. Then I think that makes you more certain about your decision. Like if you max him, for example, I think that helps.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of those guys where it's like you don't have a good alternative, right? Like if you're not willing to max him, someone else, barring a catastrophic injury next year, like if Michael Porter stays healthy and stays on the trajectory that he was on this year, he's getting a max contract from some other team next offseason. And if you're Denver, you have to ask yourself, is this the guy who completes our big three with Murray and Jokic? I think he can be. He certainly has the talent. Oh. You know, they are the ones, they know better than anyone about kind of the long-term status of his back and whether they think he can hold up under that pressure. The defense is also a concern, but I think he's making some strides in that area, and there's nothing to suggest based on his physical profile and his basketball IQ. It's like, I don't think he's going to be a horrific defender for the rest of his career.
Right. So, I don't think he's going to be good, but I don't think he's going to be bad.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's not going to be like first team all defense, but he's also not going to be such a glaring liability because, again, like, guys just got a massive, you know, what is it? He's 6'10. Like, you know, put on a little more weight, you're going to be able to hold your own against bigger wings as well. You've got the length to contest shots. So
to be fair, he's already added the weight. This is where I'm getting so sick of like the player profile pages on the internet because they don't update. Like, it says he's 6'10, 218. But many people have him like almost 230 now. He has at least very close to it. So there is more like meat on that frame now.
Yeah, he's definitely bulked up since coming in the league. But he can, you know, he can still.
Oh yeah, he can absolutely take on more. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But you know, I think Denver has to max him. I just don't see the alternative.
Yeah, now this is the case, this is the situation you're finding yourself in, right? I mean, you have a team that you're trying to win now. You have the league's MVP, one of the best players in the entire NBA. You just can't afford to downgrade. Like, one thing is if you go into this retooling process next year and you may have a chance at Bradley Beal, like, okay, then we can talk about doing something else. Mm-hmm. But unless that comes to fruition, which it might not, then he's a perfectly suitable player to have as your Well, I was going to say primary shot taker, but you know what? I'm actually going to lay off of that because Jokic this year just proved how effective he can be when he is the guy who actually is the primary scorer as well. This was an area he was very reluctant to be in, but look at what he did this year, and it helped him so much. So maybe Porter should just be the secondary guy, which would also be insane because Jamal Murray, pending a 100% full healthy return, being your number third guy?
Yeah.
Feeding off of the attention of Jokic and Porter, that could be filthy. Of course, if we ever get to that point, unless, you know, he signs with Chicago in 2023, which is...
Right, of course. Yeah, but I mean, to your point about, you know, should they punt next year, I just don't think they have the ability to, given these major decisions that they need to make. And another point toward giving Porter the extension now, I mean, one, if you don't, he's getting the max elsewhere. Maybe he decides to take a 3+1 instead of a full 5-year. So, you know, you're having more control over his future if you just give it out now. If you can get him for less, great. I just don't think that's a realistic possibility. The other is, you know, because of Murray's injury, I don't think we're going to hear Denver in the mix for another big all-in trade. Like, for, you know, Bradley Beal, Zach LaVine, Dame Lillard, anyone like that in this next year. Maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, I just think, given that, you know, you're probably going to see them decide 22-23 is our best chance to win a title with this group. So if they give Porter the extension now, it becomes really hard to trade him because there's poison pill stuff. Like, he's, you know, he would count as his current salary one way and his future salary the other way, so matching salaries in that trade becomes a lot more difficult. But if you don't, if you're not worried about that, if you don't care that you're not going to get a Bradley Beal next year, having Porter on that big contract, if you do later decide, okay, actually this guy isn't our third option, well, now you've got him on a big contract. He's still going to have the talent, and again, barring a major injury, teams are going to be interested in acquiring him. So he could be your chip to go and get a better fitting third star if that's the concern.
Yeah, I should have clarified. When I meant punting, I meant making decisions this summer. Mm-hmm. Because you're absolutely right. The poison pill thing would be an issue. Like, I was thinking, like, maybe you trade him on while he's still on his rookie deal. You add in Aaron Gordon, maybe some draft picks. Like, there are certain ways you can go about this if Bradley Beal was like, I want to go to Denver. Like, if he wanted to go to Denver this summer, for example, then that would be a retooling process. That wouldn't be punting, of course, but it would be relinquishing a lot of assets for one asset, presumably. And it would empty your draft pick clip also, which means do you still then have, I don't know, the chance of making it to the finals if Jamal Murray, like, even if you have Beal and Jokic, but you're like, have Jamal Murray back at like 40% or 50%, is that enough to make a finals run next year? I don't know, but would it be enough to make a finals the year later? Yeah, I think so. But, well, I guess it just comes down to, is there something, someone available that they can trade for? If the answer is no, I feel fully confident in just moving forward with the roster that they have, which is Murray, Jokic, and Michael Porter Jr. as the main three, and then just see how that shakes out. Because obviously, Porter is not done developing. Like, he could be a 25-point scorer by next year. Who knows?
None of them. I mean, Murray's not, Jokic. All these guys are still so young.
Yeah.
And, like,
this is true.
Had Murray not gone down, there's a real chance Denver is in the finals instead of Phoenix or the Clippers.
Yeah, you've mentioned that at least 50 times these playoffs, and I don't know if I locked them in as a finals contender, but you're absolutely right that they would have been in the running. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I probably would have... If there was a fully healthy Murray, given how they played in that brief stint, I think they would have been in the finals. So, I
could be. Could definitely be.
I think there's a lot of, you know, run it back is not always a viable strategy for every team. Denver is a team where I think it is.
Right. By the way, Marcus Howard averaged over 12 minutes per game in the playoffs. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. Thank you for that pointing count. That out.
That counts as making it to the rotation, which you laughed at me for when I suggested it.
That it does. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to the other team that got knocked out in the West in the second round, the Utah Jazz, who, man, They're lucky the Sixers flamed out in such spectacular fashion, because otherwise basketball Twitter would be dunking all over these dudes just relentlessly. I mean, losing...
Well, they are, and it's unfair, but carry on. We'll take it.
Well, losing to a Kawhi-less Clippers team like that, that's just not a good look. And I know Rudy Gobert, I think, is catching a lot of slander. To some extent, unfair. I mean, some of the same issues popped up in terms of when the Clippers went five out, and we've seen this in years past, too. It does diminish his effectiveness. That said, he was the only good defender on the floor for the Jazz for most of that series. So,
yes,
I think he deserves some credit for having the Clippers not score every time down the floor.
What I find interesting here is how everyone seems to be pointing their finger at Gobert and not recognizing what you just said there. The fact that you also need to have solid perimeter defense initially. There is a first line of defense. You can't just say, well, screw that, Gobert has it. You can to some extent, especially in the regular season, but you need to be on your A game on both sides of the ball in the playoffs. What I think is fair to talk about when it comes to Gobert is, nowadays, do you really need to have someone who is defensively oriented at the five, and then who can solely build their resume and their reputation off of defense? Isn't it better to have someone who can just be a really good defensive rebounder, but who can also put a ton of points on the board? Our friend of the podcast, Shamit Dua, has spent a lot of time on Twitter arguing that point. I personally agree with his line of thinking. But at the same time, you also have to recognize this is an interior defender who might actually be the best center defender since Alonzo Mourning. I mean, maybe even Hakeem. I'm going that far. I think he's better than Ben Wallace. I mean, he's that good of a defender. So I get the contract. I get the need. I get that he's also one of the best rebounders. I also get that he's a good cleanup guy. There's a lot of things that he does that just goes unseen, because everyone is like, oh, defense. That's the only thing. But you need to flank him with perimeter defenders as well. Otherwise, you're just exposing him. Every player needs help, whether that's offense, defense, whatever. So, yeah, I think he's catching more slack than he should.
Yeah.
And I also, at the same time, agree that he was put in a situation here and there that did, I hate the word expose, so I'm not going to use that, but did point out certain issues with defensive bigs in the fact that they can move their feet, but they will never be as quick as guards.
Right. So these two questions go hand in hand. How do they fix their perimeter defense? One, because they already have $129.7 million on their books next year, guaranteed. Right. The cap is supposed to come in around 112. So they are, you know, not only are they over the cap, they are getting close to the luxury tax already. Yeah. And Mike Conley is a free agent. Yeah. And Mike Conley is not presumably going to take a minimum salary or like $5 million a year. Like, he's probably looking at least, you know, 20-ish million. So if you're Utah, knowing the success that you had in the regular season and knowing how, you know, you did win the first round of the playoffs, do you try to run this thing back? And how much do you spend on Conley? Or if not, how do you fix your perimeter defense so you don't run into these same issues next year?
Easy. I pay for Conley, and then I pay the tax bill, because now Dwayne Wade is a co-owner. We know he's got the moolah.
Yep.
And then I trade Jordan Clarkson.
For who?
Someone better defensively. I'll figure out who, but not someone who is all offense and no defense. That's for damn sure.
Do you think that, like, Clarkson didn't start for them? So that still doesn't affect their starting five.
That doesn't matter. Like, it depends on what you get in return. I mean, if you find something that's good that works in your starting unit, you can put him in that group, and then Royce O'Neal can come off the bench. I mean, you can move stuff around. Like, this isn't a video game where you have to get a six man back for a six man. I mean,
right.
Like, if you find someone who is like super interested in Jordan Clarkson because their team has a sucky offense or whatever, but they are, have a surplus of defenders. Yeah, I would look at that. Like, if they could, honestly, if they could remake Royce O'Neal in a lab, like just duplicate him, and you could send Jordan Clarkson off for Royce O'Neal 2.0 and have two Royce O'Neals run around, I would do that in a heartbeat.
What if, let's say, Josh Richardson picks up his player option? Would you do Jordan Clarkson for Josh Richardson? Do you think that helps Utah to the extent they need?
It's an interesting deal. I'll give you that. I think it's a tough situation gauging where Josh Richardson is right now. I mean, he came into Dallas with a lot of expectations on him, and he completely whiffed. I mean, if he doesn't pick up his player option, I have no idea what he signs for this year. Like, are there teams that's even going to offer him the non-tax MLE? I don't know.
I'm sure there will be, but I don't know if it's a good investment.
Right, that's right. But like, if you're thinking that, then there are 30 teams out there that's thinking the same thing.
There are probably 29 that are thinking that, and then one idiot is going to be like, oh, right. we like Fine. This guy.
Okay, but like, yeah, I like the ideology of it. Like, if you're getting Josh Richardson, like the Miami version, sure, that'd be great. But I don't know if you are. I like the overall ideology of it, of getting someone who is a bit of a two-way player, who isn't a, you know, the player who they should get in return for Clarkson shouldn't be a complete offensive liability. So when I say defense, I don't mean someone who comes in with some sort of Tony Allen All-NBA defense reputation or something of that sort. They should just get someone in who is less dynamic offensively, but who's also a little bit better defensively. Who that is, that remains to be seen. We can actually workshop that at a later point, you and I, then we can do a video on it. I think there are some interesting names out there maybe, but I would just not see trading Jordan Clarkson as a huge loss.
Mm-hmm. Reigning sixth man of the year. How dare you? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I know. I feel so bad for removing or trading someone who won an award that's very closely attached to my heart. You're right. Yep.
I mean, I agree with you fundamentally that if they are going to make a change, I'd look at either Clarkson or Bogdanovich. But I think they do need to bring
Bogdanovich.
Yeah,
wow.
I mean, if we're talking about defensive liabilities in the starting lineup.
Yeah, but you still need scorers, and you still need someone who can really shoot the ball, I mean, and who has size. The thing is, you can get your shot off like Jordan Clarkson. Jordan Clarkson's like 6'4". Being 6'8", and being able to get your shot up, and look, to his credit, he shot 46% from three in the playoffs.
I'm not saying they need to salary dump him, but like if we're looking at a more substantive, you know, bringing in something that we're missing.
Okay, if you're getting someone in there who can defend at a higher level, which yes, you're right, that shouldn't be difficult because 99% of the league defends better than Bojan Bogdanovic.
Right.
You still need that certain someone to be able to hit threes and not at a low volume. You need someone to come in there and have a lot of games where they put up like 15, 17 points per game. Because like he is more reliable offensively than Jordan Clarkson.
Mm-hmm. What if, I don't know if Sacramento would be interested, but something around Bogdanovich for Harry B.
I like that. That would be interesting. I don't think they would be, but if the Jazz could go out and trade for Harrison Barnes without sacrificing like a ton, that would be interesting. That might actually be the thing that brings them to the finals next year. Assuming, of course, we don't see major movement around the NBA and next year we have some sort of super team. But that would be super, super interesting. Absolutely. That's a good name.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to find these guys, you know, because there are so many teams right. that are either like just pure title contention. They're not going to trade away these pieces. Like you have to kind of look right. in that middle tier of like we hope to make the playoffs. Like Kyle Anderson's another name that I would throw out
well,
there.
Well, let's stick with the Kings because they need a Bogdanovich in return after making a mistake with the first one.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, maybe they're just confused and they think they're just getting Bogdan back.
I wouldn't be shocked. Really. All right, so Kyle Anderson. Kyle Anderson is actually interesting. Let me just look up him, because one of the things that I noticed this year was just he was so much more assertive offensively. He was so much more willing to take threes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not old. Like, he feels like he's been in the league forever. And he isn't even 27. He is 27. He's not even 28 yet. He will be at the start of next season. So, like, he'll be in his prime. But we saw so much more offensive improvement from him. You have 36% from three, 47 overall, 78 from the line, 12 points per game, almost six rebounds. He moves the ball beautifully. He's a solid defender. That is not a bad plan. The question is, would Memphis even be interested in any package
that
Jazz could offer? I don't think so. But Harry B. and Kyle Anderson are great names to bring up.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Like, I think the Conley thing, they have to re-sign him just because they are so far over the cap. If he leaves, they don't have a good way to replace him. Like, you're probably not even going to have, like, at best you have a non-taxpayer mid-level, but you might not even have that. Like, you might be stuck at the taxpayer mid-level. But again, if, like, a Reggie Jackson is getting more than that in campaign, like, that might be your best hope to lure campaign with. You know, best case scenario, you get campaign at the non-taxpayer mid-level, and Cam has had a great playoff run, no disrespect to him whatsoever. Having him as your starting point guard is very different than having him as your backup point guard. You could start Jordan Clarkson, but that's not going to make your defense any better. Yeah,
that's
so,
not going to, right.
Yeah, those are the two names. I agree with you. Those are.
Well, there's one more name who I really think they need to trade. Derek Favors.
Yeah, it just did not work out as they hoped.
No, but I mean, again, to go back to Schmidt's point, right? Like, you're paying, like, the non-tax MLE for a guy who is primarily defense, not much else. Like, what are you hoping for here? What are you paying for when you have Rudy Gobert?
Right.
Like, and you're only playing Favors, like, just 15 minutes in the regular season, 13 minutes in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Like, how does that make sense?
Right.
At all?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, back when in his first stint in Utah, he started the four next to Gobert. So maybe they thought that they could just get back to that. But I think we saw with
Al Horford. But that wasn't good, though.
Yeah. And we saw with, like, Horford and Embiid in Philly, like, these two big lineups, unless both guys can do everything, but, like, neither Favors or Gobert is a three-point shooter, so you're just clogging your spacing so badly on offense. Yeah, I get the sentimental bring him back home, we know what this guy provides, but yeah, you're totally right. Like, no team should be spending a full non-taxpayer mid-level on a backup center. That's just a bad use of resources. When a guy like Bobby Portis is out there, he got the biannual, right? He got, like, $3 million.
This is what I'm saying. Like, for some reason, like, you can always find offensive bigs, like, in the bargain bin, and, like, teams have pivoted all the way into, like, paying for defensive bigs, and it's just like, what are you doing? Like, it's the guys who can score that needs to get the minutes.
Or even, like, Nerlens Noel signed a 1-year, $5 million deal.
He's one of the exceptions. He drastically outplayed that.
Yeah, right, of course. But, like, wouldn't the Jazz have been better off getting Noel 1 year, $5 million instead of Favors 3 years, close to 30?
So where can we send Favors? Is there a team that needs a starting center? Because you know what? No, but, like, let's assume that he will take the role of starting center, primarily defense and rebounding. The team will have, like, wings and like, proper wings, honestly. Sacramento?
Yeah, I was about to say, if they lose Rashawn Holmes.
Right, exactly. Like, that would be interesting.
Or Charlotte?
Maybe your hair. If Charlotte? No.
If they don't get Tice, I know.
Yeah, they no. Keith and I have already agreed to that. That's but happening.
But if they don't.
Yeah, no, that would be interesting.
Or, the Raptors, I guess? I don't really like that.
No. I mean, you brought up Harry Barnes.
Yeah.
There's your salary match.
Yeah, well, if you do.
Well, if you add in another piece, of course, but that's, like, you can do something there.
Yeah, like, you could do Bogdanovich and Favors for Barnes. Yes. Barnes and Bagley?
I like, you know what? You know how I'm always down on Bagley going anywhere? The Jazz might actually be the place where I won't mind him going.
Yeah. I think Sacramento would want a little bit more. But I think
the Jazz have their pick still?
I would think so.
If they send out like a top 20 protected first?
Oh, moving forward, you mean? Yeah. Or, I mean, they have the number 30 pick this year.
Yeah, hell. Why not?
Yeah. All right. We fixed the Jazz. That's
interesting. Yeah, I think so. Like, Marvin Bagley, this is interesting. Like, I have had such a hard time coming up with a team where I think Marvin Bagley could find success. The Jazz, I think, could be one of them. Yeah. Because he can shoot. And he is someone who can actually generate offense, and the Jazz could use it. So this is interesting to me. I like that one. They get Harrison Barnes, multiple positional defender. They have Bagley, who can work as a spot up shooter. He can also work as a pick and roll guy. I like that one, Brian.
Good. All right. Well, I would say let's fix the Nets, but I don't think we need to do much work to fix the Nets, because as far as I know, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, James Harden are all going to come back next year. Hopefully all three guys are healthy and stay healthy moving forward. Joe Harris is also signed. I guess one of their big decisions, if it even is a decision, Spencer Dinwiddie has a $12.3 million player option. I believe he's already said that he's going to decline it. Do you see any way that the Nets keep him, or is he looking elsewhere?
I'm sure they want to. But I think he's looking at the writing on the wall. Yeah. How many minutes is he going to get next to Kyrie and James Harden?
And from the Nets' perspective, when you already have $154.2 million on your books next season, that's, I think, close to $20 million over the tax already. Are you really willing to spend however much, 15 to 20 million extra on Dinwiddie, which would put your tax bill into astronomical range?
Yeah.
For, you know, a guy who profiles as like your backup point guard.
Yeah, like for that team, he's projected to be a backup. That's true.
Yeah. Well, like Kyrie and Harden are going to split the ball handling duties.
Yeah, but I'm thinking, like, it's unfortunate that they couldn't have kept him, because he's obviously a starting caliber player.
Yeah.
Like, if they wanted to pivot into something else, they could have used him in a trade. But, like, that injury just kind of sucked every possibility of that out of the way. I'm also weirded out by just what kind of contract he's going to get, given the injury.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's opting out of $12 million. That's okay. Is he going to get $15 million? Or it seems like maybe on a 2-year deal, sure. But or it seems going to be willing to lock him in for 4 years? I don't think so.
Yeah, I would guess. Like a two year with a second year player option probably feels like the right play. And I mean, maybe you do three.
Yeah, with the third year then being a team option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're right. If things go south, you're not going to want to be on the hook for that.
No. I mean, obviously you want to get him back to like the 20 plus points and 7 assists and all that, but you have no idea how he's going to look.
Right. I mean, yeah, he's a really good player and there should be a lot of interest in him around the league.
Right.
What the, you know, for Brooklyn in particular, and given some of their other needs, I don't think they need to prioritize him.
No. I think they should just to nay-nay him, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's an option if you're going to do it at this year's trade deadline.
But I just don't think he's interested.
No. Yeah, you just don't want to be on the hook at the end of the year for that massive tax bill. I mean, like, I am very pro teams spending into the tax. They should, especially if you're the Nets and you have a championship contender. But there is a point where it's just like, I can't even cape for this to happen. I mean, if you're $20 million over, your tax bill is $45 million. If you're $40 million over, it's $160 million. So that's where it gets, you know, like, it doesn't sound like a lot. Like, oh yeah, we're already $20 million over. Who cares? 45. if you get to $40 million over the tax line, I don't know. I mean, it just feels like a non-starter for most teams, and I think Brooklyn is probably one of them. Also, they have other guys who they're going to need to re-sign is the problem. Like, if they had their entire team coming back and Dinwiddie is the one guy left that they needed to re-sign, okay, maybe you bite that bullet. But the other big one for them, Bruce Brown Jr., is heading into restricted free agency. They do have bird rights on him, so they can match whatever. But again, the luxury tax becomes the big impediment to that. So how much, Mort, if you're the Nets, would you be willing to spend to retain Bruce Brown Jr.?
I would be willing to spend up to what DeAndre Jordan is earning right now, presuming that you get him off the cap immediately. So you save that money.
Oh, get the like ship DeAndre elsewhere?
Yeah. And then you basically replace Bruce Brown, wow, with what the contract is of DeAndre Jordan. So that's what's he got left? Like 2 years, roughly 20. So yeah, $10 million a year. I think that seems fair because of the defensive upside. I think there's also a little bit more of an offensive upside that people really are not talking enough about. What I'm concerned about with Bruce Brown is that he'll never really be utilized enough, considering, you know, Harden, KD, and Kyrie, and all that. So I'm wondering, like, even if you pay him $10 million a year, which I think he's worth, will you get $10 million like worth out of him because you have all those guys who'll get so many touches and will have all those responsibilities? I hope so, but I don't know.
You'll get more than you got out of DeAndre Jordan in the playoffs, which was, let me check, oh, nothing. He did not play a single minute in the playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that has to... Also, do you think, like, if you went to KD and Kyrie and went, look, we know you're buddies with DJ, but it's just time. Like, we need to move him out to pasture. Do you think that they will bark at that?
I would hope so. But, I mean, I think DA has value as a regular season minutes eater. But is he having value at $10 million a year in that role when there are guys like Dwight Howard available at the min?
Right.
No.
Right. Like, and even in the regular season, there are moments when he looks completely done.
Yeah. And, I mean, Brooklyn proved throughout the season that they can go elsewhere. Like, I think Nick Claxton is ready for more minutes next year.
Right.
If they bring back Bruce Brown, they went small ball with him. Blake Griffin and Jeff Green are their other two big free agents. You know, I think both of those guys play an important role as well. It's really just a matter of, can they bring them back at a reasonable price?
They have Alize Johnson at a good deal for regular season minutes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so they have options.
They do. Also, I'm just realizing something, Brian. No team in the NBA is going to take on Jordan's contract.
Not without something attached, but...
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. The Nets also traded every single thing under the table for James Harden. So, I mean, I guess Landry Shamet they could offer as the sweetener to get off Jordan. But
yeah, I mean, Shamet will be a restricted free agent after next year anyway.
Yeah.
I feel bad for Shamet that he will, if that happens, that he'll be on his fourth team.
I know. I mean, it's a bad, because he's a good player. It's just like bad luck.
It really is. Like, he's a good shooter. He's even got some playmaking chops. Like, I like him. I think he deserves to be one of those guys, much like with Reggie Jackson. Like, I found a home here. Like, he deserves to just get a place where they commit to him and go, you know what? The next 6 years of your career is right here. Well, and yeah, I think I actually know what team that should be. That should be the Memphis Grizzlies.
Oh, I was going to say OKC.
Interesting. That could work too. Yeah.
I'm just thinking, like, you want to find a team where you're willing to rent out $10 million in cap space for DeAndre Jordan for the next 2 years.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Take on DJ, then take on Shamet, and then knowing full well that he can, at the very least, be a very solid role player for you moving forward. Yeah. Like it, and he's young. Yeah, that's not bad.
Do you think Brooklyn's going to be able, I mean, it's hard to say because we just don't know the dynamics here, but, like, I would think Blake Griffin in particular, how he played in the playoffs, probably earned himself, you know, not $35 million or whatever he was earning before, but, like, I don't think he's going to have to settle for min deals. Do you think, especially given the way that the playoff run ended for the Nets, that they're going to be able to keep Griffin and Green on min deals or near min deals?
I think Blake Griffin chose the Nets for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for them to not win the championship might be enough ammunition for himself to go, let's run this back.
Yeah.
And he's earned so much money in his career that I don't think it matters all that much to him.
He's still earning. I mean, the 21-22 season was also guaranteed on his contract, right? So, like, I'm trying to look up how much the Pistons are paying him next year. I think
it's a super high amount of money.
$29.7 million. $29.8 million is his debt. Yeah.
And it should be noted something else. And by the way, what I'm about to say, I'm not trying to say the players who earn money away from the court should be inclined to take less. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm saying. But Blake Griffin is legitimately a household name. Like, he's in the entertainment industry. I think he has a production company. Like, he is very engaged elsewhere as well. He has several revenue channels. So I don't think necessarily that he's a guy who is lacking for a long-term contract, and I also don't think he's wired that way. He seems to be doing things that he wants to do. So I wouldn't be shocked if he returned on a min. I really wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, if you're earning 29.8 from the Pistons, like, combine your two salaries and you're still making over $30 million. So yeah, I think I have a feeling they're able to keep Griffin around on a min deal, and I would guess Jeff Green too, honestly. Based on back, you know, he and KD and Harden go back to the OKC days. The Burlingtons are back. So I think the Nets are going to enter next season as the championship favorites, because I think they'll lose Dinwiddie, but I think they keep Griffin, Green, and Brown. Maybe they pick up another center if they ditch DeAndre. Like, you know, I know this team went out in the second round this year, but, you know, had Harden not gotten hurt, had Kyrie not gotten hurt, I think we're talking about the Brooklyn Nets in the finals right now instead of the very likely the Milwaukee Bucks. So no one should be sleeping on this team, in case you're like, oh, well, they're never going to stay healthy. Maybe that's the case, but they are going to go into next year as the championship favorites, I would guess.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right that they'll go in as favorites, but I also think a full season is a long time, and I get that some of these guys were friends beforehand and all that. That's nice. I also still could see a lot of drama unfolding and, like, an athletic piece coming out revealing all this other stuff. That wouldn't surprise me. So, I mean, just for the sheer entertainment value, I'm there. That's fine. But at the same time, I'm also rooting against them a little bit for one particular reason. I am a little bit tired of seeing, like, the big market narrative consistently twirl around, like, always New York, Los Angeles, and all that. There is a part of me, now that we're seeing how open the league is and how enjoyable these playoffs have been with Atlanta and Phoenix and Milwaukee, those types of teams. Like, it's fun watching small markets. Mm-hmm. I like that. I think it's fun to see teams that really have to fight, who can't spend unlimited amounts of money on things. Well, the Bucks notwithstanding, because they pay through the nose for everyone. But I think it's interesting to see how they just suddenly find themselves in an area just by spending smartly instead of just spending from a quantity perspective.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap up with the Sixers. We have already addressed Ben Simmons' future. We did it briefly in the pod, and then we also did the big YouTube video on it. So please go check out both of those. We're not going to go deep on Ben Simmons right now. We will talk about him plenty this offseason, moving forward, I'm sure. Philly has some other issues they need to address as well. First of which being Danny Green and Furkan Korkmaz are both free agents this offseason. Which of those two, or would you try to re-sign both if you're Philly?
It depends on price tag, Brian. I mean, I would prefer to get both back. I think Danny does have some use. I know a lot of people look at him as, you know, this 34-year-old who really can't play anymore, which I think is such a faulty premise. I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
Yes, his three-point shooting is a bit erratic, and yes, his defense isn't as consistent as it used to be. I get that. But like, he's not a bad player. I mean, he's still someone you need to guard from the outside. He's still someone who can come in with sneaky blocks and sneaky steals. He's someone who is a versatile defender. Sometimes he can even pick up point guards. So, like, I would think that he should be back. Now, would I want to pay him $15 million a year? No, that's definitely not. I don't think that's in the cards. What I'll pay him, I'm not really sure, but I would want him back, and I would also want Korkmaz back for one reason, and like, this might be, like, maybe you find an alternative to him, but one thing I liked about Korkmaz was he wasn't passive. He wanted to shoot that rock.
Yeah.
And he came into the game, every single game he was willing to shoot. He just came in and said, give me the ball, I'll shoot a three, because the Australian won't.
Which Australian?
Fair. But, I mean... Yeah. Oh God. But I mean, look, it's he. I think you need that kind of, I don't know, like F you mentality.
Yeah. No conscience whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not saying you should pay through the nose for him.
Right.
I don't think so. But like you just need something like some sort of edge.
Yeah. I mean, so they have full bird on Korkmaz, early bird on Danny, but you know his salary was so high that like he's not gonna reach the level that would become an issue. So they have the ability to bring back both, and I agree with you. I think depending on price, they should try to. You know, Danny, like I keep saying it, but I really do not think it's a coincidence that as soon as he went down in that Hawks series, the Sixers just lost their composure for five straight games.
Yeah,
like he is a very important piece to them, and you know I think he's brutally honest as well. Like, I mean, he went on a podcast after the season was over. It was talking about, you know, Ben Simmons, like, doesn't want to be challenged, or, like, unless you directly challenge him, he's not going to go take this thing on himself. Like, his experience with the Lakers and with the Spurs and with the Raptors, the guys in the locker room are praising him all year as being, you know, this positive locker room presence, positive veteran presence. Doc loves him, and you know Danny said at the end of season presser that like Doc went up to him and was like, you're not going anywhere, don't worry. So I think they will try to prioritize him. Korkmaz, I'm with you, like I wouldn't spend $10 million plus on him per year, but if you can bring him back at a reasonable price, not only do you need that consciously shooting off the bench, but he's also, you know, he's not a great defender by any means, but he made strides on that end defensively, like noticeable strides this year. You know, will he be a fixture in the playoff rotation? Probably not moving forward, especially if Tyrese Maxey takes the leap that they seem to think he will. But it's similar to what Utah is dealing with Mike Conley. If you lose Furkan Korkmaz, you'll have the taxpayer mid-level if you're Philly, especially if you bring back Danny. And that's it. Like, you don't have a ton of flexibility here. So are you going to get a player who is better than Furkan on a min deal, or are you just willing to go into the tax to re-sign him?
Yeah, and maybe you just do that just to have him so you can flip him like later on for something else. I mean, he's gonna be 24 at the start of next season. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are making decisions out there who are looking at him going, that would be interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's a good seg into one of their other decisions. George Hill has $1.3 million of his $10 million, $10.0 million guaranteed for next year. If you're the Sixers, would you guarantee that contract, knowing that, you know, he never quite made the impact that you thought he was, that you thought he would, when you made that deal at the trade deadline?
Nah.
Oh, interesting.
For one reason, I would want both Matisse Thybulle and Tyrese Maxey to get more minutes, mm-hmm. and that probably means no George Hill. Otherwise, I would not trust Doc not to play Hill over those guys.
That's a fair point. Yeah, Morey needs to, if he does pick it up, he needs to have a clear directive of do not take salaries into account when you are assigning minutes next year.
Right, right. I mean, because Tyrese Maxey, to me, I mean, he's got some upside in terms of, I don't want to say he can become an all-star. I also don't want to say he can't, because we've seen weirder things in this league, but he's got a skill set that is pretty unique, and his energy is just off the charts. I wouldn't be shocked if he's one of those guys who has like a major second year dump, like maybe doubles his points per game. So I just want to see how far you can take the Maxey train.
Yeah,
really. And I think that if that means like sacrificing George Hill, I'm okay with that.
It's clear Morey in his presser repeatedly said, you know, talked about some of the young guys they had on the roster, and it was clear he was referring to Maxey. Doc has been singing Maxey's praises all year, said he's the hardest worker.
Well, Doc sings everyone's praises.
I know. But, you know, he was saying, like, he's the hardest worker on the team. He's, like, they love the kid. They absolutely
DeAndre
love
Jordan
him.
Is the defensive player of the year. Bar over there is the best ball bar in the history of the NBA. Look.
It's fair. But I would actually guarantee George Hill's contract. For one reason, salary matching. They just do not have good salary matching chips. So if you, well, I mean, we'll see what they do with Ben Simmons this offseason, but if they don't trade him or they save him for a bigger deal, whether it's Dame, Beal, you know, hope one of those teams just goes completely off the rails. You're going to hate me for saying it, but Zach LaVine as well. You know, save George Hill's contract as well in case you need to make that deal bigger. But yeah, if George Hill continues to play at the level that he did upon coming over to the Sixers, by next year's trade deadline, that's when you're probably looking to get him out of there. And, you know, that gives Maxey a little bit of time at the beginning of the season to get used to a bigger role before you really, like, throw him in off the deep end. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Morey was kind of saying, like, the development of our young players, I think Maxey and Thybulle are the two he was really referring to, but also B-Ball Paul, G League MVP B-Ball Paul, Isaiah Joe, who they took with a second round pick as well, nice little sharpshooter off the bench. If those guys can grow into bigger roles, that's going to alleviate a lot of the concerns we had about the Sixers' depth this year. It's just they had to replenish a lot because they screwed up for five straight years.
Ryan, shut up about the Sixers now. I've like, it's my turn now because you have had plenty of Sixers talk on this podcast over the past 5 years. Come on, Seth Curry. I want to talk about Seth Curry. You're like all the way into B-Ball Paul and Isaiah Joe, who's played like 2 seconds in the NBA. I want to talk about Seth Curry, every player who's getting real minutes. What he did in the playoffs, Brian, was outstanding.
Yeah.
And it's not just, I understand that he had percentages in the playoffs that is not bound to be replicated. Like, he shot 58% almost from the field, 51% from downtown. That's not going to that's not going to be the norm.
Right.
That said, he should shoot more. There is a path for him to become more than what he is right now. I don't want to see him taking like, I don't want to see Shake Milton, for example, take more shots than him in less minutes. Like, that shouldn't be the thing. Like, Seth Curry should get considerably more shots in the flow of the offense. He can find them, he can find his own spots, and he should take so many more threes than what he is already doing. Mm-hmm. I want to see Doc next year use Curry in a different way. I think if you flank Joe and Tobias with a more high volume Seth Curry and whatever you're getting from Ben Simmons in a trade, that is only going to make all those individual pieces that much better.
Yeah. I wouldn't count, as you said, what Seth Curry did in the playoffs is clearly unsustainable. Like, I don't think Seth Curry is going to be at a near all-star level. And if he needs to save that for the playoffs, by all means, that's great. I would like, you're right. I mean, Sixers fans were clamoring all year for him to, like, he needs to adopt Korkmaz's mindset.
Right.
It's just like, if you are open and you catch that ball, do not pass it. Just let that damn thing fly. Like, for such a high percentage three-point shooter, he is so strangely passive at times. And maybe it's like, maybe you are a high percentage three-point shooter because you are only picking the shots you feel the most comfortable with. Like,
right.
I'll live with you hitting 41% instead of 45 if you are taking 8 threes instead of 5.
I mean, look, but going off his career, it seems like the high volume, the more he's hitting, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Maybe that's the pathway. If he takes 12 threes, he's hitting 60%. Maybe that's the move forward. But honestly, I just want to see him take, like, let's just say he takes 2 more overall shots per game, and then he takes, like, less two-pointers per game as well. Like, he converts some of those into threes. Mm-hmm. So, like, next year, he's taking 12 shots per game, and, like, 7 of them are threes. I would love to see that.
Yeah. I would have zero complaints.
Yeah.
I think the last big question for the Sixers, we won't get into like backup center and taxpayer mid-level targets, because all of that depends on what they decide to do with Ben Simmons. Joel Embiid's eligible for a Supermax. If you're the Sixers, do you offer the full thing? And do you have any sort of contingencies in there? About, especially with injuries, like what they did with his current max contract.
Yeah, I offer it, and then I load it with every type of incentive there is. Again, if he's down for it. Because, look, I get it. He's been healthy for a while. Like, he's such a dominant presence now that you can't not offer it.
Right.
But at the same time, it still feels like he's playing on borrowed time.
Yeah. Yeah, I offer it and I am nervous as hell.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it.
I mean, maybe Jokic and the Nuggets would have proved to be the exception, but I asked you this the other day in the DMs, like, what's the last team that had their primary offensive option was a center? Like, last championship team.
You actually said big, and then we came up with Nowitzki, right? Yeah. Or Duncan. Yeah, and then Duncan wasn't really, like, the proper selection, because that was in 2013, and that was more Kawhi and Tony. Like, Duncan was not the featured player. Mm-hmm. So it's been a while.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, maybe Embiid and Jokic are so good that they can be the sea change here. And Embiid, like,
yeah, maybe Jokic could be that good. You're right.
Look, Embiid deserves all the credit for the improvements he's made this year, but
yeah,
he also needs to continue getting better. And then there's always going to be the question, until he makes it through the playoffs healthy 1 year, which he still has not really done. I mean, okay, right. Yeah, he didn't get hurt during their first round sweep against the Celtics last year because they were off for 4 months beforehand.
I don't even consider that a proper playoffs. No. Because that they were dead on arrival.
Yeah, but. Like, until we see him make it through, there's always going to be the question of, can he stay healthy throughout a single playoff run? Or are we, you know, is it what we're seeing with the Clippers and Kawhi now? Where it's like, you're going to get to April or May every year and be like, we hope he's available, but we're not sure.
If the Sixers end up somehow, some way with Dame.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would argue that Embiid wouldn't be the featured player.
Yeah. All right.
So maybe that's the workaround.
There you go. Think about there you go. Yeah.
Historical context.
Yeah. I like it. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you all, as always, for listening in today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios. Give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Mort, next time we talk, for all we know, could be the finals. So enjoy potentially the rest of the conference finals. We'll catch up in a few days.
Thank you. You too. It would be amazing to see some sort of wacky NBA finals. I'll be into it.
Yeah. Bucks Suns, yeah. Baby. Get
Bucks Suns. And also, Brian, it won't be long until we start having some draft talk, because that is a month away from right now.
Yes. Very true. All right. Later, man.
Later.